School Leadership Podcast from NAHT Edge and NAHT.
Hello and welcome once again to the School Leadership Podcast brought to you by NAHT Edge and NAHT. This month we bring you another high-profile guest from the world of education. Nicky Morgan was the Secretary of State for Education up until July of last year. In this episode, we ask her what it's really like to be the Minister in charge of education, what she feels was her most significant achievement, and whether she has any regrets about her time in office. We also hear from James Toope, the CEO of education charity Ambition School Leadership, about how they're supporting leadership development in schools.
This is the School Leadership Podcast.
It's time now for the first part of our interview with Nicky Morgan. Edge Director James Bowen met with the former Secretary of State at the Houses of Parliament at the end of a long day of Brexit debates and started by asking what she saw as her biggest achievement in office.
Well, I was thinking about this. I mean, I think it's probably for other people, you know, to make their judgments. I guess ultimately, at the end of the day, you've got to think, have you delivered for the young people? And I think the fact that we now have 1.8 million more children in schools rated good or outstanding, you know, has to be right at the top there, because if you believe, as I do, that education is the greatest investment we can make in the future of our country, then if more young people are getting a great education that sets them up for life, then that's got to be, you know, a good way to go.
And the other side of it, I suppose, the obvious question is, with the benefit of hindsight, is there anything you look back and think, actually, I would have done that differently if I had a chance to do it again, or perhaps something that you would perhaps not have done? Is there anything you'd have done differently?
Well, I think we're going to come on to talk about primary assessment, because after that was a huge area for the NAHT and for us to discuss with the NAHT when I was in office. So I think that's certainly one thing that, you know, I wish we'd been able to make more progress on, and also obviously handled the Key Stage 2, the SATs and the problems and everything else. Not handled differently, but I wish they hadn't prior to happened at all, the problems. I suppose, I mean, one of the things that people have said, you can't be proud of, but I am, is the white paper, which attempted to say, look, this is how we want the whole school system to be as strong as possible. What does a school-led system really look like? And I think probably, you know, trying to explain to people what academies and free schools are about. And also, you know, one of the things I'm delighted in the system is that there's more people sharing best practice, but really trying to bring it alive to people, what it means for people at the front line to be in charge of their schools and their destinies. Because I met brilliant head teachers, primary and secondary, who were doing just that. But then I met others for whom actually they hadn't really seen that in action. And I wish, you know, we were able to get that message out just a little bit more about what it's really about.
And do you still feel, obviously, with the white paper going there, the move away from forced academisation, but is it still your view that academisation, a universal academisation system, is the direction of travel you'd like to see schools go in?
Very much, very much. I mean, I do think that actually, as I say, when I went around the country and I met talented, you know, heads and leadership teams and teachers and everything else, I mean, that has to be the right way to go, which is that actually it's them that are running the system, that are directly accountable, that are able to work with others to make their decisions. And I suspect we'll get there. I'm talking to others in the system. You know, there's still a great move towards academisation. And so there's obviously still great appetite and interest out there. And I think that's got to be the right thing.
And so it'd be just to ask for your view on the role of local authorities within that. Because I think when we speak to head teachers, local authorities, of course, like anything, there's good ones and
Absolutely.
Not so good ones. And we do speak with head teachers who say, actually, the local authority we work within is a really strong one. It supports us well. We like the support we get. We like working with them. Is there still a role, do you think, for local authorities within that future system where they're working well, or do you think that's...
Well, we said that there was, and I think that's right. I think in the white paper that local authorities, rather than being the providers of education themselves, could be the people that shone a spotlight on local education. If there are problems, if there are good things, if there's ways that actually, for example, services that local authorities offer that they do exceptionally well, so things like safeguarding, for example, or admissions, that actually schools would really want to still work with the local authority on that. I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? I often found the people that told me they had great local authorities, actually, when you went and looked at the figures, it probably wasn't quite as great as they thought it was compared to other parts of the country. And I think that's one of the things that's a challenge about education, is that you don't get that movement often of different types of schools, or between different types of schools, between different parts of the country, So if you've always been an educator in one part of the country, that's what you know, and that's the kind of support for local authority you're used to. But actually, I could probably give you other examples from different parts of the country where actually the things are even better or have advanced even further. And again, that's what I think that the school-led system can really generate. So people aren't hidebound by sticking within local authority boundaries. They're able to work the school just down the road, which they never would have done if they were in a different authority.
And if I can ask you now about when you took over Secretary of State at the department. Obviously, you took over at a time where there was a great deal of change. You inherited a department where the previous Secretary of State had started a lot of large-scale policy changes. There was a lot of change going on in the system. And I'm interested to know, how easy was it for you to have your own agenda when there were so many large-scale policies in terms of assessment and other things that had already been set in motion by your predecessor?
Well, I think you're right. I think there were a lot of changes, and that was obviously a challenge for the system and for people working within the system. And I really wanted, and David Cameron wanted me, to continue with those big reforms. But there were things like the emphasis on character education, on mental health, changes we were able to make to children's social care. And don't forget, that's a vital part of the department. It often doesn't get the attention that it deserves. As well as things like workload, which I suspect we'll come on and talk about in a moment. But so I was able, I suppose, to say, look, the big reforms are going to continue, but actually there are things that I think even Michael would know hadn't perhaps had the attention or had fallen through the gaps that actually I was then able to pick up, workload being a good one, for example, where people were saying very clearly, this actually does need to be looked at. And so I was able to work with Nick Clegg when I first came in, who was obviously then Deputy Prime Minister, to launch the workload challenge. And, you know, I'm really pleased I was able to do that.
I think I read recently as well, you sort of said that one of your roles when you came in is you inherited a department where things have been a bit controversial. Yeah. And there was an element of you being asked to, perhaps not the right phrase, but smooth things and calm things down. Yeah. Is that a fair representation of what you are asked to do in the role?
Yeah, I mean, as I say, David Cameron was very clear that the reform agenda continued. You know, he was absolutely passionate. And I think you couldn't have had a Prime Minister more interested in education reform. Obviously, don't forget, he had been a shadow education secretary, albeit for quite a short period of time. So he had very firm views on things. But yes, I mean, what we wanted, like what I particularly wanted, was MP colleagues to be able to visit schools in their constituencies and genuinely talk about the reforms, what's happening on the ground, what was good, what was not so good, and then feed that back to me, rather than having to deal with lots and lots of noise, which didn't then actually contribute to a productive discussion. So I did want to calm things down. And I think we did that without letting up on the reforms in terms of the raising of standards.
And you've touched on the point previously about everybody having a view on education. Mm. Everyone's been through school, so they know how the system works. But I'm interested to link that to the point you've also mentioned about, you know, the challenge for a politician, an MP, who suddenly gets asked to take on a large department, who may have not had experience in that particular field. So, you know, you're asked to take on perhaps the education department and you haven't got experience in education. How much of a challenge is that? How easy is it to overcome? And I suppose the third question related to that is, who do you look to for advice, particularly when you were, you know, in the Department for Education? Were there particular people that you trusted, that you went to in terms of to get their thoughts and advice on policy?
Well, I think to start off with, so when you're appointed, I mean, as a minister, and I think it's hard to explain, you know, outside politics, but you're there as a minister really to exercise good judgment. And I think it's really important that elected politicians are there in leading roles in departments because ultimately, we also go back to our constituencies. We listen to people, to the electorate, in a way that departmental officials do not. And there is a thing about having to listen. You know, I mean, as a politician, you're on a 5-year job interview, basically. It is a 5-year job interview. You know, every 5 years, you've got to renew your franchise. So you've got to listen to what people are saying. Then you have to make your own decisions and your own judgments. So you're not there to know the detail of everything. But I think you know, education is full of acronyms. And I used to find sometimes it's quite good to go along to a group of people in education, you know, having a meeting and say, sorry, what does that mean? Why are we doing it that way? And, you know, to say to people, OK, I'm coming at this as a parent, and I don't know what you're talking about. So why is anybody else going to know what you're talking about? And to remind people that actually, you know, you've got to think about the parents, the pupils, the families, as much as what's right for the professionals in the education system. And so I think that's, you know, you're, as I say, you're there to challenge. I think what I was saying, you know, in the previous interview was you're suddenly promoted or thrust into running a department, particularly you haven't been a shadow spokesperson. That you don't own a department, you're in a leadership role, you've got to, pretty unforgiving media who immediately want you to know every single answer under the sun to every single complicated issue. And, you know, we don't sometimes have a good enough way in this country of saying, you know what, I'm a new Secretary of State, actually, I haven't yet formed a firm view on that, and I'm going to listen and take soundings. In a way that you could do probably in most other rational jobs, and people would understand where you were coming from on that. And in terms of taking advice, obviously you've got people in the department. I mean, you're not short of people sending you in bits of advice. I mean, people like NAHT and the unions as well, we'll be meeting them. But, you know, the greatest sounding boards are the people I met doing visits. They're actually sitting down in staff rooms, in round table discussions with teachers and heads, talking to my local heads as well, but talking to other parents. You know, that's where actually you're able to say, but hang on a second, you know, I'm being told this. What do you do here in this school? How do you tackle workload? What do you think about character development? How are you doing life without levels? Is really important. And there was, and I think I've given an example before, of the name the GCSE got changed because I went to a school visit and one of the teachers said, well, why are we calling it that? And I thought, actually, that's a really good question. Why are we calling it that? And I went back to the department and said, let's change it, please. And they went, oh, okay, all right, fair enough. And so that's the sort of thing that you're able to feed back. And that's why the visits and getting out from behind your desk and getting out from Whitehall is so important.
You've spoken previously, I think in previous interviews, about your relationship with Number 10 and indeed Secretary of State in general, their relationship with Number 10. And I think it'd be really interesting to understand how that works in terms of how much policy with an education perspective is driven by Number 10, how much freedom do you get as a Secretary of State? Just really interesting how that dynamic plays out.
Yes. I mean, as I say, I had in the Prime Minister who was very interested in education. He felt very passionate about the reforms. And so, you know, he was interested. And at the end of the day, certainly when I was there, Number 10 very much held the ring in terms of wider government announcements, because what you don't want is, you know, five sectors of state all making big announcements on the same day. So, you know, you've got to say, well, look, we need to say this. And there'll be some things that are driven that just have to be announced. You know, on certain days there'll be results coming out, or, you know, GCSE results or A-level results or whatever it might be. And there'll be other things, you know, new changes of policy or emphasis that you are then able to nuance and announce on the day that works, you know, for the overall programme of government, I guess. In Number 10, there's always policy advisers. We had Rachel Wolfe most of the time I was there, who was the, and Laura Trott actually before her, who were the education advisers to the Prime Minister, so you work very closely with them. And I'll be saying that most of the time, you know, we everyone gets on. You know, we're all heading the same direction, we're all in the same party. But there are times, you know, that actually you'll say, well, look, this does need to be tackled. And because they haven't had those conversations or that frontline sort of experience of the visits, they'll go, really, does that need to be, you know, addressed now? And you say, yeah, absolutely. Things like workload, for example. It's not that Number 10 wouldn't have wanted to do it, but they'll be saying, well, okay, why has this come up now? How does this fit with what we're doing? So you work out policy, you work out package, you know, you bring them on board. We have a very close relationship with Number 10. And as I said, I think that helped overall in terms of things like securing slots for announcements, but also in terms of support with the budget and the Treasury.
And are there times on the flip side where you always have to push back, if that makes sense? Are there times where people, you know, Number 10 that say, we'll have an idea in terms of education and you're closer to the action, they would say, actually, we don't think that will work, we don't think that's quite right.
Oh, yeah.
That must be quite a challenging part of the role,
yeah. I imagine. Oh, yes, it does happen. Because, it goes back to everybody's interested in education. So everybody will come in, you know, with a story maybe from their children's school or from some of the conversation they've had, and they'll go, I've got this great idea about doing this. And you say, well, if we weren't doing the other five things, then we could probably have some bandwidth for that. Or actually, that's not the best way to do it. But actually, there is a kernel of an idea in that clearly does need to be addressed. So let's take it away and work it up. So I guess it is a sort of mutually dependent, you know, relationship, which it should be. But there are times when you just have to say, you know, actually, we're just not going to go down that path. It's not right for now. It's not right for what the system needs. And again, I think that's where, you know, the Secretary of State and advisors are hopefully a useful interface between, you know, the wider education system and sector and politicians.
In the second half of our interview, we find out more about Nicky Morgan's view on the government's proposals to expand grammar schools. And we also ask for her thoughts on the controversial primary assessments that took place last summer. First, we have a quick update from the CEO of Ambition School Leadership, James Toop. James starts by explaining what the charity is about and how it supports the work of school leaders.
Ambition School Leadership is the new entity that brings together two organisations that some of the listeners to this podcast may have heard of, Teaching Leaders, which was a national charity dedicated to developing outstanding middle leaders. So a real close affinity there with NAHT Edge. And then also that was coming together with the Future Leaders Trust, which was essentially designed to deliver to high quality senior leaders, heads, and then more recently executive leaders. And so we're really continuing the mission of both charities. So we're still going to continue working in the most challenging context, the most challenging schools, running our high potential leadership programs at both middle leader, senior leader level, and also at executive level, but trying to really make sure that we can weave those programs into a pathway, a career pathway for leaders at all levels of the system and support them right the way through their career journey. And also see how we can work more strategically with schools and groups of schools to better serve their leadership needs through a wider range of leadership solutions.
And you've mentioned the specific leadership programs you run. For perhaps people who don't know too much about them, could you explain for us how do they work and what kind of experiences might you expect to have if you're on one of those programs?
We've got three flagship programs. So we've got Teaching Leaders, Future Leaders and Executive Educators. Teaching Leaders is targeted at high potential middle leaders. It's a 2-year program. It's selective. So you join a national cohort of middle leaders, but we'll have a coach, a residential. It's about a month's worth of training over the 2 years of the program, all focused on an impact in your year group or subject area to have a greater impact on pupil achievement. Future Leaders, which is our second flagship program targeted at people who aspire to headship within the next 18 months to 2 years. It's again a selective program which has a big 2-week residential coaching and really is about accelerating people who perhaps didn't think they'd get to headship in 2 years to get them there faster. And then Executive Educators, which is for executive heads and CEOs who are moving into that role and really wanting to get the nuts and bolts of that role and help them transition to that executive leadership role. And then we offer a range of other MPQ programs and other programs at all different levels of leadership as well. But those big flagship programs are probably the ones that we are best known for.
And are the programs available effectively to anyone, depending wherever they are in the country? And how would people go about finding more and indeed signing up if they're interested?
So the programs are all available nationally. Our mission means that we specifically address schools that are in areas of particular challenge. So that could be high levels of socioeconomic disadvantage. It could be that there are large achievement gaps or that disadvantaged pupils are performing below the national average as well. So it's that group of schools that we target. There's about 6,000 schools out of the sort of 21,000 schools in the country that we work with. And probably the best thing to do is to go to our website, which is ambitionschoolleadership.org.uk, have a look at the eligibility criteria, give us a call if you want to find out more, and one of our team can talk you through whether your school is eligible and which programme might be right for you and your leaders.
And how does it work in terms of funding? Do individuals pay for the training? Is it school funded? How would that side of it work?
So for the Teaching Leaders and Future Leaders programmes, there's a government subsidy that accompanies those programmes, and there's also a school fee. So for our Teaching Leaders Secondary, it's £4,000 for the 2-year programme. For Teaching Leaders Primary, it's £1,000. In the Future Leaders programme, it's going to be somewhere between £2,000 to £3,000. And then our Executive Educators is fully funded by participants. So there's no government subsidy alongside that. And that programme's just under £5,000 for executive heads and just under £10,000 for CEOs.
It is the School Leadership Podcast, brought to you by NAHT Edge and NAHT. And it's back now to the second part of our interview with Nikki Morgan, which starts with the former Secretary of State reflecting on the primary assessments that took place last summer.
Well, I definitely think one of my undone things was about getting primary assessment right. And I had long conversations with Russell and the NAHT, and we wanted to do more on that. And I think politically there was always that sort of concern about we've got a system. There was particularly the thing about the baseline assessments, everything else as well. You know, let's see how it works. And I think there are, so we should separate it out. One is obviously the problems that happen with the test papers. And obviously the new thing, but there's also the overall thing about primary assessment, which, as I say, I'd like to have had done more on. I understand ministers are looking at now and discussing, and I really welcome that. I think we haven't quite got the right system. We do need to know, and actually parents want to know, how their children are doing. But what you don't want to do is have such a testing system that primary school, you know, in particular, becomes very focused on the tests and not on helping young people to flourish and to discover their talents. And then, of course, we have the specific issues about the papers. You know, the paper that had been online for a while. You know, the paper that you know got released, there were problems. And I have to say, I felt, you know, I was really very sorry about that, because I knew how much effort and hard work both pupils and teachers have put into preparing for those tests, and how let down they felt. And you know, I hate letting people down. And both times, you know, Nick Gibb and I came to the Commons Chamber. We answered questions on it and everything else. I hope that, you know, in both situations, we were able to react pretty swiftly and to clarify what we expected people to do or to not to do in terms of actually taking those papers. And I guess, you know, look, we have to learn, the system has to learn by its mistakes. And I was very clear internally that actually what happened was unacceptable, and it did have consequences for officials. And I think that's right. Again, you don't want to sort of, you know, hold people, punish people unnecessarily, but people do need to know about the, and to reflect on the amount of work people outside in schools have put into preparing, and it's not acceptable to let them down or not to know that there's going to be a problem.
If I just pick up one of the points you said, interesting around the idea, I think there's a feeling perhaps in the system that the tests have come just perhaps so high stakes, there's so much importance and value is attached to what effectively boils down to a group of children, 45 minutes, sitting a paper in May. Do you have any a sympathy, if you like, for the view that they've become so high stakes and that they have too much impact on the life of school?
Well, one of the things I was very careful about was, or wanted to tackle, was the whole sort of football manager syndrome, where, you know, head teachers feel, you know, it's a huge stress for them, and then they're given a hard time by governors or by parents, you know, if results aren't good enough and everything else. And I know from personal experience, and there's a whole variety of reasons why you can have a very talented year six, you might have a year six that struggle, and, you know, you should not be. And so, for example, we introduced the coasting of failing schools measures, and, you know, we absolutely wanted those to be judged over 3 years, because it's not right for a school to be judged on 1 year's results. Now, having said that, I think also as a parent, I'd want to know if there was a particularly poor year, you know, is there a reason for that? And I think it's right that people should ask the question, but also show understanding. So I was also always very clear when we were doing Ofsted reforms, everything else, and Michael Walsh, I think, was clear with the inspectors, that they had to understand what was going on behind the headline numbers and results. Because there's a whole variety of reasons. As I say, you might have a school where something very difficult has happened amongst a year six, or you've got a year six with particular needs or something like that. And actually what you don't want is to find that school is penalised on the basis, or the head teacher feels that they have no choice but to resign or to offer their resignation to the governors. But on the other hand, I also see, having a son who has gone through key stage one tests, you know, we eventually, and it was before I was Secretary of State for Education, we eventually said to the teacher, so have they done the key stage one? Oh yeah, they've done that last week. So I think we also have to guard against ourselves putting our own adult pressure on the young people in the system. And, you know, there are ways, there are schools that are able to do these tests in a way that reflects their importance, but doesn't make them so high stakes that it stresses out the children. And I remember, I think it was in TES, around the time of the test, there was a poll done of the young people, you know, year sixes, I think, taking the Key Stage 2 tests, who said actually they seem to be taking it within their stride. And I think, again, with young people, actually, it's often the stress of the people around them that, you know, can be a danger. And if you don't build it all up, then actually it's possible for young people to take these things in their stride. You know, at the end of the day, life is full of stressful situations. So we do need to help young people prepare for those stressful situations. I don't think we do them any favours if we say we're going to protect you from taking, you know, tests or anything else before you've reached secondary school.
And interesting you said about the football manager syndrome, because it's a phrase that we often hear, you know, often hear heads talking about the football manager syndrome. And it's interesting to hear that you've heard that as well and more aware of that.
Yeah.
How much progress do you feel you were able to make in your time towards kind of moving away from that culture. Do you feel there was progress made on that?
I think I'd like to think there was some progress. And I think particularly on things like, you know, the discussions we had with NAHT about the implications of the tests taken in summer 2016 for measuring coasting and failing schools, and actually the floor level and what would happen to schools that fell under the floor level, and trying to reflect the fact that we were not looking to suddenly send lots more schools into a category. And as I say, we work very closely with Ofsted as well to say to them, look, inspectors must take all the circumstances, the fact these are new tests, the fact that the system is changing, into account before they condemn, you know, a school to being in a particular category or criticise the leadership or anything else. I mean, the difficulty is you're working with individuals and you're working with 17,000 primary schools. So it's hard sometimes to get those messages out. And there are people who don't want to hear those messages. So I could be as conciliatory as I liked, but I was still the evil old Secretary of State imposing new tests.
And if I can turn now to workload, which you mentioned, because I think that's probably something that the impression definitely came through in your time. I'm interested in what it was that convinced you that something needed to be done, what it was that got to that point in the thinking, and what you think needs to be done next. Obviously, we've had the three reports, and what you think needs to be done now to really improve that situation in schools.
Well, it's interesting. I think it probably came about from visits, again, to schools up and down the country who were talking about this and talking to individual teachers. You know, I read all my own emails. It came to my Parliament account. I signed, you know, literally thousands of letters to members of Parliament and to others who wrote to me, you know, and if they talked about workload, and I could build up a pattern pretty quickly. I think we launched it in October 2014, and it was pretty clear early on, you know, within the first couple of months that was clearly something that people were talking about. And, you know, I'm really proud of the fact, and I think if you want a school-led self-improving system, actually the workload challenge and the three reports hopefully helped to exemplify that, because we had three really talented head teachers who led those groups with other teachers and other, you know, other heads as part of their groups. And they came up with some very practical recommendations. You know, some things for the department, some things for Ofsted, but some things for schools as well. And I always used to, because I knew it was a concern, when I went to do visits, I would, if I could, specifically ask members of staff about workload. And sometimes I'd do it with the head teacher standing there, and sometimes not. And what was really interesting was that some schools clearly had thought about it and were thinking about ways to try to relieve workload pressures, whether it was being very explicit about what they didn't expect on marking, how they wanted colleagues to work together to share lesson planning, how they were trying really hard to try to reduce the amount of data that had to be, you know, inputted and collected and everything else. And I tried in the department as well, you know, to say, look, what data are we asking for? Do we need all of this? What could we do when we get people to input things once, but then we as the department are able to use it in a variety of different ways? In terms of what happens next, I mean, I think the worst thing away would be for the department to say, aha, we have all the answers. Because we clearly don't, and the department clearly wouldn't have all the answers. I think if there are specific asks, probably to go back to look at the recommendations to see which ones have come into play. But I guess if I were there, I would also lay down a challenge to the profession, which is what more can the profession do? What needs to change? So, for example, things like marking, you know, there are some people who clearly are able to mark in a way that, although it's part of their workload, doesn't dominate everything. And some people who are still pursuing this deep marking, which I'm not sure actually benefits the pupils, but clearly takes a lot of time. And I would also issue the challenges not just to teachers, it's to senior leaders and head teachers as well, which is, are you asking the questions? So sometimes I would get emails from teachers, you know, 2 o'clock in the morning, clearly very upset, we've been working terrible hours, and the rest of it. And my first question back to them would be, have you spoken to your head teacher or line manager about this? Because you must tell them that you are reaching breaking point, because they must know. It's too easy for line managers to pretend not to notice that somebody is really reaching the end of their tether.
And if I can finish, maybe just a couple of questions in terms of where we stand now with things and looking to the future. You've been, I think, fair to say, relatively outspoken in terms of your views on grammar schools and the proposals around that. It'd be really interesting just to hear, as I think, fair to say that you've come out and said you don't think that's the right path to go down. Why you think that is, what it is that, particularly about those proposals, and you'll know the NHT position probably on this already, but it'd be interesting to know what it is, particularly from your point of view.
Well, one of the things I'm proud of in the white paper was that we mapped those parts of the country where I would say the educational underperformance is entrenched. And I feel very strongly that young people in those areas deserve the best schools, better schools, and better, you know, the best teaching and everything else. And I suppose my concern about the proposals, and we wait to see obviously what the government is going to say in response to the Green Paper, the response they've had on that, is that I don't think that the selective school proposals really tackle those areas of entrenched underperformance. And I just know that the department, like any department, only has so much bandwidth to deliver reform. And so if you think that the big challenge of our education system now is those parts of the country, and I think that Justine's rightly called them opportunity areas, that really need that focus, then I would say getting, you know, the best teachers and, you know, great school sponsors into those areas is what's needed, rather having more structural reform and more selective schooling.
And you mentioned Justine Greening now in post. Mm. Interesting, what advice would you offer? Perhaps have you offered, have you had the chance to offer advice in terms of as she takes up the new role? And where do you feel the government now should be focusing its limited attention in terms of education policy?
Well, firstly, I wouldn't be so bold as to offer Justine advice. I think there's nothing worse than your predecessor. I'm here to support. And, you know, I have to say, Michael Gove was supportive if I asked him, particularly at the beginning, because I think often you're presented with decisions and you want to know that actually, you know, were you looking at this, Michael, or what was the thought? And I, you know, sat down with Justine on the Monday after the reshuffle and went through all the things that I've been working on, all the things on my sort of to-do list, primary assessment being, you know, one of the top ones that we need to get sorted, for example. And I think, she's got Justine's the focus on opportunity areas, social mobility. It's absolutely right. And I think post-Brexit, particularly if we're going to have more controlled immigration, we're going to have fewer people coming here from overseas, we have to make sure that our education system is leaving young people with all the skills they need for life in the 21st century and for the workplaces of the 21st century. And that's going to be our greatest test. And I think we're doing better. I think in terms of things like English and maths, which are the ultimate vocational subjects, you know, obviously the standards are rising, but keeping that focus on making sure that every young person is going to have the best start in life.
And in terms of your future, now you're no longer Secretary of State for Education, do you still intend to keep involved in education? Do you have plans to stay in that area, or do you think it'll be a completely different focus now?
Well, I mean, obviously I've done quite a lot on other areas, and as I say, what you don't want to be is the kind of spectre at the feast. You want the new Secretary of State and ministers to be able to get on with what they're doing. I mean, one of my things is I'm writing a book on character education, which I did feel very strongly about. We launched when I was there the DfE, the Character Award, the Character Grants. And I've had the privilege of going around a number of different schools around the country who won those awards and asking them about their character work and why it's important and what they do. And so I'm going to sort of focus on that. And one of the other things is PSHE, which again was probably on my to-do list, didn't quite get there, in terms of introducing, you know, some specific curriculum, space in the curriculum for PSHE. And I'm sort of proposing or supporting amendments to the Children's Social Work Bill. But I think the department is already geared up for that. I know ministers are very sympathetic, and so I think it'd be great if we're able to get there, you know, supported by MPs, if the department is able to deliver on that.
NAHT Edge is a union and professional association aimed at teachers with leadership responsibilities. Whether you're a subject coordinator, year leader, key stage leader, early years leader, Senko, or head of department, we offer full trade union protection and high quality advice. In addition, our weekly newsletter and monthly podcast keeps you up to speed with the latest developments in education. Membership of NAHT Edge costs just £13.50 a month. Find out more by visiting www.nahtedge.org.uk.
Teaching. Leadership. And the latest developments in schools.
Thanks once again for listening to this episode of the School Leadership Podcast. We're always interested in hearing your ideas for future guests. If you have a suggestion, why not drop us a line? NAHT is a professional association and union for school leaders. NAHT Edge is the part of our association aimed specifically at aspirational middle leaders. To discover more about the benefits of being an NAHT Edge or NAHT member, go online to nahtedge.org.uk/join or www.nahtedge.org.uk/join. You can follow us on Twitter. We're at NAHT Edge and at NAHT News. Until next time.